really interesting thing that he wanted to know was, you know, how was my sex life? Because that to him was the thing that I would probably find most important. I mean, actually, I was telling him that the insomnia and the migraines and the night sweats and the brain fog, and actually all those things were quite important to me as well. But yeah, the one thing was, yeah, how's your libido? And that was the one question he asked me. Actually, all narrators, all first-person narrators are slightly unreliable because they only tell their side of the story. A lot of the time, they don't know anybody else's. There is absolutely the idea that in society that women who talk basically should shut up.
Hello, welcome to Bestsellers. I'm Phil Williams.
And I am Natalie Jameson.
And there's a reason why she's singing her name to you. Natalie's very, very, very excited today, aren't you?
I am, because today's guest, Joanne Harris, is, I've read her books for 20 plus years. And not only have I so enjoyed her writing, I just think she's a lovely person. I love the way that she is so supportive of other writers, and always has been. She used to be a teacher for a long time. She's just like a great all-round voice, I think, to have in the world of books and publishing. And she's so inclusive, and yeah, I just think she's great.
I agree. I've interviewed her several times on the radio, although we've never actually met. And what I like about her is that everything's considered. Everything's got its place. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
There's
yeah.
There's no fat in these books. Everything's there for a reason. And
it's true.
She explains it really well in this interview that you'll hear. And the book is superb. And you'll hear me at the end of this appeal to the male listeners to not be put off, because the book covers things like heavy bleeding and menstrual cycles and the menopause. And I know sometimes just hearing those things, some men, some guys go, oh, that's, I don't want to read that. Just give me a Jack Reacher book. But honestly, please don't be put off. This book is superb. So without further ado, here's a fully scripted, full of facts, loaded with quality information introduction from Natalie Jameson.
I'm genuinely touched that today's guest has put aside some time to talk to us. She has written 23 novels, I think, two collections of short stories, a Doctor Who adventure, a self-help book for writers, which I use regularly, and A Woman Totally After My Own Heart, three cookery books. She's also a scriptwriter and a lyricist. She plays in a band. I first came to her writing, like many, I suspect, through her 1999 bestseller, Chocolat. Her latest work, Broken Light, is a thrilling tale focused around the power of women's empathy and so much more. Joanne Harris, welcome to Bestsellers and thank you.
It's great of you to invite me. Thank you.
So nice to have you. So before we get going fully on Broken Light, I think because you're a brilliant storyteller, can you set it up for us for people who know nothing about this book?
Okay, well, it's a book about women's rage and the patriarchy. And I wrote it alongside my cancer treatment and COVID and Me Too and the Sarah Everard murder. And it kind of came out of almost nowhere. It's not linked to any other book that I've written. And okay, it's a kind of riff on Stephen King's Carrie, set in London. And imagine if Carrie White had actually not got her superpowers at puberty, because everybody knows that teenagers are absolutely filled with drama. Why would you give superpowers to a teenager? What if instead she had survived adolescence, got married, had a child, got a job, and developed her superpowers at menopause instead? What would happen? What would her powers do? What form would they take? So it's very much a kind of metaphor filtered through a sort of supernatural story, I guess. But yes, it's about the experience of realizing when you hit about 50 that suddenly you're invisible. and that that's not necessarily a bad thing.
And is there any wish fulfillment in there? Would it be easier to tackle menopause if you did have a superpower?
Well, I think it's already a superpower in some ways. I think we just don't always recognize it as such because we are so hung up on the idea that we are supposed to be a certain kind of body, a certain kind of shape, a certain kind of level of attractiveness. And none of those things are powers, actually. They are things that are told to us early in life that are not necessarily true. And realizing that they are not true and that you have a life and a power and an autonomy outside of those things is actually extremely empowering.
But there is, you do address in here some of the issues that some of my female friends have had around menopause, for example, around HRT and access to HRT, doctors' attitudes towards wanting to go on to HRT. And these are things that a lot of my friends have experienced. And I know Natalie and I have, should point out, we've chatted before this so that I've made sure she's comfortable in talking about her perimenopause, where you did get HRT but couldn't physically get it. So you had no problem with the GP. You couldn't get the drug.
Yeah. Oh, I couldn't, yeah.
We common tale.
It's a very common tale. I mean, I didn't really have an option, but when I spoke to my GP about this, he said verbatim, "Oh, I don't think it's that important. I could always refer you, but it's probably best to let nature take its course." And I actually gave the heroine of my book that line because I thought it's just too good to waste. And that happened. That happened 5 years ago.
See, I want to ask you, because I'm a man, I want to ask you, was that attitude in your GP because they were a male GP? Was it because they were in the job so long and it was an old-fashioned approach to menopause, or is it something else?
I don't know, but that GP was a man in his 30s.
Right.
And the only really interesting thing that he wanted to know was, you know, how was my sex life? Because that to him was the thing that I would probably find most important. I mean, actually, I was telling him that the insomnia and the migraines and the night sweats and the brain fog, and actually all those things were quite important to me as well. But yeah, the one thing was, yeah, how's your libido? And that was the one question he asked me.
Yeah.
Yeah. You've had that question as well, have you, Nat?
I've had that question. It's one of the earliest questions you get asked when I've got two kids, and after you have your first kid, that's the first question they ask. It's like, you know, how are you feeling about, you know, sex again? I'm like, I'm not feeling anything about sex. Like, piss off. Like, I've got a tiny baby. I'm not sleeping. I'm really anxious. Like, genuinely, that's the last thing on my mind. But sure, yeah, whatever.
Can I just say I'm staggered that you get asked that?
It happens all the time.
Honestly, I'm so staggered. You talk about the brain fog. There's a friend of ours, Sam Walker, who's been very open about her perimenopausal state, and she's a broadcaster. Mm. And she started speaking like Yoda, and all the words are coming out in the wrong order. And surely that's got to be preference rather than, are you having sex at home? Surely.
Well, you'd think, wouldn't you? But I do think that in a society where whatever you do as a woman, you are still going to be judged primarily on how attractive you are to men, it's still first and foremost in people's minds. You know, has this affected your attractiveness and your attraction to men? And it sounds stone age, but it really still happens all the time.
Wow, well, I'm embarrassed that happens.
I'm not here to represent
all men either. I'm aware of that. But we should pick up this story then. So Bernie Ingram's 49 when we meet Bernie, and she's in menopausal, married since the age of 18. And I felt quite an isolated woman, hasn't got really many friends, doesn't really know her colleagues that well, doesn't really have the support of a husband. And yet there's no suggestion that the husband is cheating now, but there's still some kind of, just, it feels a very disparate, isolated household.
It does. And Bernie is quite a sad person initially. She is isolated. What she's done is she has really never had all that many friends. She has married very young because she was pregnant. And she's married her high school sweetheart. And what happens in the case of Bernie is that she's still in love with him, but he has stopped being in love with her quite some time ago. They've stayed together because of their son, who is now adult. But Bernie has given so much of her life to her husband and her child that actually she doesn't have any life left for herself. And so she is isolated and she's quite shy also. And she was never popular at school. She was quite like Carrie in that respect. She was always feeling a little bit of a freak. And so she is now hitting a moment at which, you know, even the amount of attractiveness that she felt in herself has deserted her. Her son's left home. Her husband is completely involved in his job. She has a little job at a bookshop, but she really doesn't have much of a life outside this home that she's made.
Yeah. There's so much. It's hard, like, talking about this book because there's so much to relate to, I think, from a female perspective, for sure. But I know, Phil, as well, you were kind of fascinated by the use of blood in the story. And
well, I'll come on to that in a second. I want to just, so that people are clued up before we get to that part of the conversation, I want to just tell you, as a reader, Joanne, what I felt her, you've talked about her superpower. Let me tell you what I think the superpower is, and then you tell me if I've understood correctly or not, okay? Because I also know from your own website that you wanted to leave the superpower kind of ambiguous as well, right?
Yeah, so, I did. It's not really up to me to tell you whether you've got it right, because there's no real way of getting it wrong.
Oh, okay,
but go
that's
ahead,
good to
please.
Know. Okay, well, that's really good. That's really reassuring to know. So I felt that she was, because at first she talked about going into people's homes, and I took that literally, right? And then I realised she's not doing that. She's kind of going into their mind, what I would call their mind maps, and she's able to either leave notes or move things around that can alter their behavior. So kind of predatory behavior can just completely flip and become the opposite. And at first I was thinking, well, if she's got this superpower, surely the first person she'd tackle is Martin, because then she could put the home situation right. And then it becomes clear why that isn't the case later on in the story, which we won't spoil for you. But I noticed you've mentioned Stephen King very early on. And one of King's traits is, I think they call it in literary circles, the butterfly effect, don't they? So for everything that someone's able to change in a superpower way or a supernatural way, there has to be a repercussion. And despite being menopause and blaming the menopause for this, Bernie bleeds quite heavily when she's done something like this. Was that the butterfly effect? Is that what that does? Is that you telling us she's bleeding heavily, not necessarily because of the menopause, but because she's gone and done something and tinkered with something in someone's mind?
Well, I wanted that to be a kind of visual theme. I mean, in perimenopause and even in the first stages of menopause, you can sometimes get episodes of heavy menstrual bleeding. And Bernie is getting these episodes. She hasn't bled for 6 months, and all of a sudden, bloom, she's horrified to wake up to find herself in a pool of blood. And in a way, there is a bit of a resonance there going on, because also in the real world, in the world outside her that doesn't really affect her much, there has been a murder. And a young woman has been murdered in a local park very close to her. And the bleeding and the vision that she has of this woman and her attacker are kind of linked. So you're right that all her symptoms, all her menopausal symptoms are actually linked to her talent, this emerging ability that she has, which may or may not be in her mind, but I do think that she has it, to look inside people's minds, to look beyond the thing that they want people to see, which is, you know, that everybody has a house in their head, everybody has a front room to which people are invited and things are neat and tidy and all their favourite books are there. And then there are the back rooms that nobody goes into, the ones where all the secrets are buried, and Bernie can go into there too, and she can even, to a certain degree, move the furniture about. But everything that she does has got some kind of effect, because actually, whether we're talking about psychic powers or not, everything that we do has a reaction of some sort.
Yeah.
And so she is at the same time fascinated by the fact that she can do this and also terrified that she's going to break someone or do something horrible to them.
So
because
she says in this,
she blames herself for everything that happens in the world.
She says, I was under a curse of blood, a curse that would last nearly 40 years. And I wanted to ask you, is it a curse or is it a blessing?
Well, I mean, I don't think anybody really enjoys menstruation. I remember when I started, I thought, my God, this is going to happen every month till I get old. Mm-hmm. Why can we not stop it? It's
I didn't necessarily mean menstruation, though, you know what I mean?
But, you know, menstruation has been referred to as a curse by women for absolutely generations. And it's been linked to sin. It's been linked to, you know, original sin and the fact that women are just basically supposed to suffer because they're women and that's somehow all right. And so I've kind of riffed on that idea.
I'm with you. So that quote I gave you, that's more to do with that, is it, than to do with the superpower?
More or less, yes. I think in a sense, Bernice powers emerged very young and then disappeared. And I was playing with the idea that puberty is a kind of spotlight that makes you suddenly visible and potentially attractive. And that spotlight basically is so bright and you're so concerned with it and whether you're having a good hair day or whether you're fat or whatever, that actually you don't look inwards anymore at yourself and your own power. In effect, it takes your power away. And so having lost that in her mind, she now comes back into her power. And as an older woman starts to understand that just being visible to men is not everything. And in fact, it's quite interesting to be invisible, because when you're invisible, you can do all kinds of things and nobody knows you're doing them.
Yeah. I was reading this book at a very interesting time. So I'm pretty sure I've been perimenopausal for the last 3 years. I think it kind of started with me not very helpfully around March 2020. So when I was having quite a lot of anxiety and erratic periods and spoke to the doctor, it was all put down to COVID and anxiety around a pandemic, and nobody mentioned menopause at all. And, yeah, you know, you trust people in authority and all the rest of it. But then I've literally started HRT about 3 weeks ago. And I was reading your book in parallel to sort of recognizing that I was feeling different and just feeling more like myself than I had done 4 years. And I think it's really interesting to see menopause as some kind of superpower. And my husband especially had noted that one of the hormonal treatments that I was taking, he was like, oh, it's like it's basically taken your filter away. So he's like, it's really funny, you're just kind of literally saying what you think now. I'm like, God, have I literally been suppressing that for decades? And I think that's kind of what menopause, it's hard to know whether it's linked to bleeding or if it's just linked to age and frustration. But, you know, for so much in society, women have felt muted. And I love that you explore that so eloquently in this book. And I assume that was a real attraction for you as well, to kind of go really deep on that.
Yeah, it was. I think, you know, there is absolutely the idea that in society that women who talk basically should shut up, and that the best kind of woman is one that doesn't really say anything except yes, dear, and you're right. And, you know, when we hear people talking about women's voices generally, there is this language around them, the idea that women are shrill and aggressive when they have ideas and they express them, whereas men are being authoritative. And the positivity of male aggression as opposed to the negativity of women's aggression or women's rage. So there's a lot of anger in this book. It's not necessarily my anger. I'm not generally that angry a person, but there is a lot of, this is unfair. Why is this happening? Why are people the way they are? Why do they see me the way they do? Or why do they not see me when they see these other people? And that there's a lot of the idea that somehow Bernie is channeling her anger into this newfound ability that she has. And when she uses it, she often gets hot flashes. And I have deliberately said hot flashes, not hot flushes, because hot flushes are something different. But Bernie's hot flashes have an element of the paranormal about them, as well as just being a menopausal symptom. So I wanted to make it clear that there was something slightly different about these symptoms, that they were also attracting another kind of effect.
Yeah. And I'm curious to know as well, Phil, because I read a lot of this book, and obviously this is not what's a polite way to put this, like, not much of it seemed a surprise to me in terms of the writing about how women are viewed in society. And I wondered if you were shocked or surprised And I know, like, not talking for all men and for all women, but just in general, as a reader, did it kind of surprise you?
No, is the short answer to that. Because almost every female friend I've got has experienced some level of sexual assault.
Mm.
Or had an issue around consent and had to really enforce a no before something, an approach has stopped. So that didn't shock me. Also, I was on air consistently throughout the hunt for Sarah Everard and also for then the arrest of Cousins and the subsequent trial. And women's groups were constantly coming on and explaining to us that they just now, you know, that you talked about trusting authority with your prognosis in March 20, and that, that was a medical authority. Mm-hmm. There's still a huge issue around trusting a police officer.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Huge it issue. Was a huge betrayal of trust and an institutional betrayal of trust when we looked at the background of it and the fact that there had been massive red flags around Wayne Cousins for some time, and they had decided that they weren't important enough to act upon. And I think, you know, that was one of the most dreadful things about that dreadful case. But yes, I think we are generally bound as children to assume that adults know better, and particularly as women to look at patriarchal figures and to assume that they are right and that they know better than we do and that they are there to protect us. And of course, none of these things are necessarily true.
No, and it's one of the things I'm most grateful to my own dad for, because I think it's probably why I became a journalist, was he said to me very young, like sixth form, he said, don't assume that just because these teachers are in a role of authority, they're right.
Absolutely. You
know, politely question. Don't be rude, but politely question. And I've always politely questioned authority. And I know you have, Natalie Jameson. So don't look at me like that.
I've politely questioned authority since, I would always, I think my teachers must have hated many, some of them liked me, but many of them challenged me because I'd always ask why. That was always my question. I was like, well, why is it that way? And I went to a Church of England school, and I had many questions about religion that couldn't be answered. So
it's funny that it's becoming on the psychiatrist's chair, isn't it? You know, while we talk about this, can I mention Iris, who's another character in this?
Oh, yes.
And I was intrigued by Iris because you talked about the rage, Joanne, and I think Iris personifies the rage. And actually, she's all for, there are parts of this book where she's all for, and she sets fucking people up, and she's all for the revenge. And there was a part where I thought, is this going to go a bit Man on Fire now? You know, with Denzel Washington, and is that the book? Is that what actually we're going to get? Is that a load of these men who've done wrong are going to get given a lesson, you know? But Bernie doesn't want to do that. So explain the contradiction between the two in your mind as the creator.
Well, I put Iris in there because I wanted Bernie to make a friend. And also I wanted to look at the experience of a younger woman. Now, Iris is a bit different. I'm not going to give too much of the plot away, but very early on in the book, Bernie saves Iris from being sexually assaulted and possibly raped by a man who is trying to drug her, trying to date, rape, drug her. Mm. And the result is that they become friends. Iris also undergoes a bit of a personality change, but she is a great character. She is young. She is in her 20s. She is. I deliberately chose her as being as different to Bernie as possible. So she is positive. She is active. She is sexually aggressive, actually, in all sorts of ways. And she has very little moral center. I mean, I love her dearly, and I think everybody should have a friend like Iris, but she is also, on some level, a potentially dangerous psychopath. And she pulls Bernie out of her comfort zone in a number of quite alarming ways, but Bernie needs to leave her comfort zone. Bernie has been living in a little box for all her life, and I felt so sad for her. She had to get out there, and she had to have somebody who would enable her to become herself.
I just wanted to ask about the bleeding side of things, in that I imagine that your editors and your publishers are very in tune with who you are as the writer. But if there was ever any pushback on the amount of blood in there, which I love, because again, it's one of those things that we just don't talk about it very much. You know, half the population is bleeding every month, and we kind of pretend that it doesn't exist. Like, one of my most frustrating facts is that, like, we couldn't even put blood as red in adverts until about 6 years ago.
Absolutely. Because it's blue blood. Yeah, I know. It's crazy. What? Yeah, you know what? I thought, well, I mean, we're back to Carrion, because I was riffing on Carrion. There is this absolutely dreadful tampon scene in Carrie, but it's very clearly a scene that's written by Stephen King. And so it's about teenage girls and the shame of periods and the horror that other people have for this. And it, to me, it's a very male voice writing that scene. And I wanted to write it in a different way with a very female voice. And so I put periods as they really are, which is, you know, as I see them. Actually, my son was the editor of this book, one of the editors of this book. And he said, oh, put more in. Put more blood in, because it's great. It's like a body horror. Which, how old's your son? In a way, it's 30. Right. And, you know, it's true. It is a bit like a body horror in that respect. But we are, as women, often encouraged to be horrified by our own bodies, by the things that they do wrong, that are unappealing. And again, we're talking mostly about being unappealing sexually. But, you know, the horror of menstruation, the horror of menopause, the horror of different bodies, fat bodies, trans bodies, you know, this kind of disgust that people are fed early in life and that affects their behavior later on, it's all a trick. It's all really garbage, because we are who we are and we change throughout our lives, and all those changes are valid and they're part of who we become. We're not supposed to stay the same as we were at 16 forever.
No, but we fed the opposite as well, aren't we? So as well as you're right, everything you just said there is right. But the opposite is, whenever you look at the front page of a newspaper website or whatever, the image is always someone who's defied the aging process. Look at Jennifer Aniston. Look how gorgeous she is. She's over 50, but look at her. She still looks like she's 30. That's the narrative, isn't it?
Yes. Well, I mean, the thing is, when they show these images, it's always of a woman who doesn't really look her age.
Yeah.
Or a woman who was so beautiful to start off with that the fact that she is now 20 years older and still the same shape and still has the same hair and is wearing lots of lovely makeup and clothes, it's not really embracing age at all. It's going, look, I can still look young at this age. But it's always, the emphasis is always on the fact that they look young and that the fact that they look sexually attractive. You know, you don't see women of a different type occupying those places. And what you do get is a lot of kind of serious bitching in the papers about, ooh, look who's put on weight. Ooh, look who's dangerously thin. Ooh, look whose hair is looking thin. Look who's wearing a wig. Look who doesn't look good in a swimsuit anymore. There's a lot of that, even for young women. And old women just disappear completely, unless they are one of the three old women that are still in the news, and they are expected to be the ideal of what you look like when you're old. Not that the word old is ever used, of course, because, you know, nobody's allowed to, because old is still seen as a bad thing, which, of course, it isn't.
It is. And also, it's like, it just doesn't make sense. It's like, I don't see what the point of it. Well, I do see what the point of it is, but it's not like any of us can stop aging. So you're automatically creating a trap for so many people of repeating that shame spiral, which is appalling. I don't want to kind of dwell on the male-female thing the whole time that we're chatting, but I did just want to mention a quote that comes up quite late on in the book, but I don't think it's a spoiler because I've kind of removed any context around it. But I thought you had encapsulated this so well, which was, you write, to the man who has always viewed the world from a lofty pedestal, equality feels like a step down. And yeah. And I've heard other authors speak about this. In that similar way, if you have to, the problem with privilege as well is that you have to relinquish some of that to allow others to join that space. And there's that notion that there is enough for all of us to share in everything, but that's not what we're told, or not the way the world views it often.
No, I think that's true. And I think it's been said in different ways about privilege in lots of different contexts, and it's still true. You know, we all have levels of privilege, and we all have levels of mostly unexplored unconscious bias. And part of the book is about exploring a little of that and asking questions about it, what it means.
Yeah.
I think now is probably a good time to get you to read a little bit, isn't it? Well, I think we've kind of set up enough about Bernie and the kind of power that she has. Where are we going to join the story for your little excerpt?
I always struggle with this because I'm never sure how much I can give away. So I'm going to just read something from the beginning.
Great.
And this is not Bernie speaking. This is her friend Kate, who also narrates part of the story. And it's about their childhood. When we were children, Bernie and I, magic was easier than sums. It was the kind of magic children never think about, the kind that adults don't notice. I remember I could change into a pony, a rabbit, a bird, anything I wanted to be, even a boy if I wanted to. That's what Bernie told me. In those days, the world was infinite. All our doors were open. A lifetime of possibility where all the choices were mine to make. I don't remember much of it now, but I do know it was real. And I know the moment I lost it for good, and who took it away from me, the way so many men take away the power they find in women. But I'm not going to talk about him right now. He isn't part of my story. Even writing his name gives him power. And he was small and ridiculous and doesn't deserve our attention. And yet, this is why we're here, I suppose. Even though what happened was terrible, let's not pretend that's not why we're here. Because Bernie Ingram wasn't a freak. She could have been any one of us. In some ways, maybe I think she was. Maybe she was that part of us that still believes in magic, in change. Yes, I know what she did. But I can't find it in me to blame her. A part of me would have done the same. A part of you would have done it too.
Very nicely done. I could have listened to that for hours for a start. Have you done your own audiobook?
Not this one. Not this one. Imogen Stubbs did this one, but I have done some of my own audiobooks.
I wanted to ask you about audiobooks briefly as well, actually, as a minor digress, because you've recently recorded four earlier ones, right?
So can you just four on the trot. It was crazy. It was actually such fun to do.
And that's all to do with rights and how the world has changed in terms of how we listen to books now.
Yes, in the old days, audiobooks were all abridged because nobody really wanted to buy 30 cassette tapes or something to listen to a book. So I'm getting the unabridged rights back, the ones that I gave away for nothing and which weren't really used. And so books that I wrote 20 years ago, I'm now recording in my voice for Audible, and they will be coming out pretty soon, I think. So it's great to do it, but the new ones get done by a proper actor, which is always nice. And Imogen's recording is just fabulous, and I'm so happy we got her. I really wanted to have her do it.
How do you find the recording process for yourself? Because they're long days, aren't they?
They're quite long days, but I am also quite used to it because I read for a long time to my kid when they were young, and actually when they were not so young, I read to my brother when he was young. I was a teacher for 15 years. I did a lot of reading then. Mm. And because a lot of the stuff that I do with my band is storytelling, I read a lot with that too. So I tend to be in practice, and I don't make a lot of mistakes. And so, it feels like a pretty clean, enjoyable process.
Reading aloud is great. It just reminded me of a memory I'd totally forgotten. When I was at primary school, this will come as my mum listens to these religiously, and she was always being hauled into school because I'd been too cheeky in class and a chatterbox. But again, I think this was just me questioning and using my voice. But one of the things, I had a really lovely teacher who, if everything was getting a bit much when I was at primary school, they'd just be like, Natalie, can you just come and read to the class? And it'll be a way to shut me up, basically. Whatever book we were reading, I'll just read it out loud to the class.
I think that's something that they used on me too.
I used to love it though. I didn't ever think of it as a punishment or as like a way to, I was like, okay, yeah, I can do that.
The excerpt that you just read for us, that's in Kate's voice. again, without giving too much away, is Kate there to assist us, the reader? Because is Bernie a slightly unreliable narrator, given what she's going through? Is that why Kate's there?
Well, I think actually all narrators, all first-person narrators are slightly unreliable because they only tell their side of the story. A lot of the time, they don't know anybody else's. And in Carrie, there are two narrators there's at least one other narrator, and she is basically a popular normal girl who is looking at Carrie from the outside. Now, I wanted to do that with Kate, too. This time I gave Carrie a first-person voice, if you like, in Bernie. Carrie doesn't have that in Stephen King's book. It's all third-person stuff. But there is this other girl, and she is there to balance the freak. Now, I don't think Bernie is a freak, and so I don't quite do that. And I don't have this sort of nasty girl-on-girl action that Carrie has so much of, because actually I didn't want to go that way in the story. But Kate is somebody who has been Bernie's friend as a child, and who has moved away from her because she's afraid of becoming unpopular like Bernie. And yet they have this connection. And they have this affection between them. And so she is a constant presence in Bernie's mind. And I wanted to give her a voice so that we would see the difference between the way Bernie thinks of her and the way Kate thinks of herself, and the way she has also interpreted how Bernie has changed over 40 years of knowing her.
I feel like full disclosure now that I need to be honest with Joanne. I haven't read Carrie and I haven't seen Carrie. And I think that I was going to ask you if I should or not. Should I tell you why I haven't seen it? Is because I saw the trailer and just looked horrible. I just thought
horrible. It is quite horrible in a lot of ways, but it's also very interesting. I would watch the original one because the performances are so good. Okay. Even though it is slightly dated, I think it doesn't hurt. Also, I think the book is slightly dated too, so that's fine. It's a very short book. It's one of the shortest of Stephen's books because he is not necessarily, he's a guy who writes a lot of words when he's writing novels. And this is a very spare novella, long short story. But it's interesting. It's an interesting story. And although I there are lots of things that I don't like about it, I do think it's compelling.
Do you think that my enjoyment of your book has been hampered by not reading it? Because I came to your book cold and loved it.
No, not at all.
So I haven't missed anything.
It's a nod and a wink to Carrie rather than a sort of massive homage. But so many people in fantasy know Carrie that if I say to them, right, okay, the short pitch of my book is Menopause Carrie, they will understand what I'm talking about and I don't have to explain.
And also, Natalie, again, without...
Have you read it or just seen it?
I think I read it when I was like late teens. I saw the film when I was 13.
Wow, that's young.
Which really stated it was one of the first horror films I saw, thanks to my sister, who's a couple of years older than me. And I loved it. It's brilliant for like jump scares and like a false ending. And what I think it gave me in coming to Joanne's book is there's mention from the offset that the kind of the school prom was a big deal. And they're kind of leading up to a reunion that may or may not happen. And the anticipation of what happened in the past at a prom and what might happen when people get together was just delightful.
Yes, I thought I couldn't really resist the idea of having some version of Carrie's prom. And so instead I make it a grown-up reunion of people who are at the school. But, you know, we know that when people go to high school reunions, they revert to their high school selves. This has been observed over and over again. So what will Bernie do? Will she explode, or will something else happen? Who knows?
I just wanted to pick up, Phil, on something you said when you were talking about Bernie, and in some degrees she could be viewed as an unreliable narrator, but I didn't see her as that at all. I fully trusted her voice. But I think that's interesting because often one of my long-held fears is that as a woman, you will have a really rational thought, but it might be out of character to how you are day to day, and people will assume that the rational thought is the false one, the crazy one, that something's gone wrong. And the terror that actually, no, I've just like got this crystallized version of the truth. And now you think I'm crazy. So I wondered if some of that was kind of coming into play with your thoughts of it.
No, the reason why I thought she was unreliable is because there's the whole ambiguity around the superpower. Mm-hmm. So that's so for me, I was like, is she really doing this or is she not? Do you know what I mean? That was the, and then obviously when you get to Kate's chapters, they're much more factual to a point, and until you get towards the end of the story, the denouement. So that's why that was purely on that level, no other level.
So just on the magical realism side of things, which is something that I really enjoy in books, like I adore Alice Hoffman's writing, especially as well. Is that something you obviously love playing with, Joanne?
Yeah, I've kind of been playing with this concept of magical realism, although I'm not sure that that's how I think of it. Mm. As I think really what I've been doing is playing at the idea of different kinds of realities and different perceptions, because we all perceive the world in different ways. And to every individual person, that is reality, which is why reality can't really be objective, which is why all narrators are unreliable, because mm-hmm. you are getting their story. You know, unless you've got a sort of supremely omniscient narrator, you're not going to see everybody else in any kind of, you know, sincere way. And so I quite like the idea that, you know, for Bernie, all this is absolutely objectively true. For you, you can choose how you see Bernie's story. Are you going to completely follow her perception of the world, or are you going to introduce something of your own in there? And it's all allowed. It's all possible. So this can be a story, an absolutely magical realism story of a woman with superpowers at puberty, who loses them and gets them back at menopause. Or it can be the story of a deeply confused woman who is menopausal, has brain fog, has false memories, has been traumatized in youth, has suffered a great deal, and has crystallized all these experiences into a metaphor for her rage. You know, what happens to her? Who knows?
Can I ask you a couple of technical questions on the composition of the book? Firstly, that I'm fascinated by it, because I know everything you do for a reason, right? So the structure, a lot of the chapters are done in kind of song titles, but there's poetry quoted throughout. Naina Cherry's Manchild plays a huge role in this. If this wasn't a podcast, it was a radio show, we could play some of that now. But I think the laws around that stop us from doing it. But
yeah, afraid so.
Explain what you were trying to do there with that type of structure.
Well, a lot of this book is ostensibly written on social media. Bernie's diary isn't a paper diary. It's basically a live journal. And I have chosen a very old-fashioned form of live journaling on purpose, because Bernie doesn't really want anybody to read her diary. It's private, but it's also public. It's there so that her husband Martin won't read it, that nobody will read it. But it also has to be found at the end of the book, because stuff is going to happen and her life is going to be scrutinized and her voice must be heard. And so I thought, okay, she's going to put this stuff online. Now, live journal tends to very much be about how you're feeling, journaling online, and very often has music, musical things accompanying it. So I thought, okay, we're going to write this like a playlist, because music is really important in this book anyway. Music, there are certain repeating leitmotifs to do with music from certain times in Bernie's life. And I thought, okay, we're going to write it like a playlist, and we're going to construct it like this, and we're going to keep riffing on some of the ideas that will come out in these songs. And if you know the songs, then you might get a little clue or a little Easter egg about what's going to happen. And if you don't, it's fine, because you're going to find out anyway. I did this once before with a book called Blue Eyed Boy some years ago, and I created a Spotify playlist that people downloaded and used with the book. They can do that with this too, if they want to.
I did that.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah, it's really good. It's a lovely touch, because you feel fully immersed then. It feels like much more of an experience. The reading is a great experience, but when you've got the music alongside, providing this soundscape to what you're reading, to what the eyes are telling you and the ears are telling you something, it's really good. There's a whole load of extra clues in there for us to
I quite like the idea of the fully immersive book.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which is why I write so much about sense impressions and smells and tastes, as well as just visual and sound things. But I like the idea of a book having a soundtrack. I think a lot of writers write to music. I don't actually do that, but I do create playlists for books to kind of get me into the mood, because music is a deeply emotive thing, and it elicits responses that can sometimes be unusual and startling. And I just like the idea that you know, you can play with that in a book. And it's a choice. If people don't want to do that, if they don't like music, or they don't get that idea, they can just ignore it.
Or words in heavy doses. final technical one, just from me. The title of Broken Light. How did you arrive at Broken Light? And was it always Broken Light? Were there any contenders? And the only reason I ask you that from a personal bias is because as I'm reading it, I had to check a couple of times that it wasn't called Made You Look. Because that crops up a lot, doesn't it?
It does. It does crop up quite a lot. I was originally going to call it Not All Men. My publishers didn't like that idea because they thought it might upset people. It's probably going to upset people anyway if they're upset by that kind of story. But I thought, okay, we'll do it differently. We'll take a different angle. And I mean, the interesting thing about Bernie is that she feels both at the same time heavily scrutinized by the society she lives in, but also very invisible. And there's a lot of stuff about mirrors. There is stuff that there are, you notice that there was poetry at the beginning of some of the chapters. There's a lot of stuff about the Lady of Shalott, who in the poem has to look at the world through a mirror. And if she turns away and looks at the real world, something awful will happen. Well, Bernie looks at the world through the screen of her computer, and her mirror is the internet. And she's slightly afraid of looking away from this carefully curated world into the real world, and what will happen to her if she actually breaks away and experiences herself, what will happen. She is a very fragile character. She's always feeling as if she's easily broken. And so it got me thinking about the idea of breaking light, and you know, she is able to shine a light into people's heads. But broken light is interesting because only by breaking light can you get the rainbow. And so I thought, you know, this is what she's doing, actually. She is a person of intense fragility and great empathy. And this fragility of hers is actually part of her superpower.
And do you think
you can only get that by breaking light in the first place?
And if you had got your way and called it Not All Men, I just wonder from a male perspective whether that might have tilted my bias towards the story to be looking for the male characters to see what they've done rather than listening to Bernie.
Quite possibly. I mean, there are male characters in there and they are not all great guys. But I don't think anybody in that book is all good or all bad. I've tried to make everyone, even the objectively awful people, I've tried to give them some balance and something that we can understand, if not actually like or relate to.
Was that difficult? Was it difficult to get us to root for Bernie? Because I was rooting for Bernie.
Oh,
even though she does some devilish things.
I'm completely behind Bernie.
Me too.
You know, she's far from perfect, and she's done all kinds of things that were big mistakes. But ultimately, you know, she is not a bad person. There are some objectively bad people in the story, but she isn't one of them.
No, she's great. And also, I think it's worth mentioning that much of your writing is really funny as well. This is, you know, this isn't a, like a dour book that's just kind of tipped towards anger and really interesting, but obviously weighty subjects. There are some moments that I laughed out loud. There was one that I'm going to butcher terribly, and I don't want to give too much away, but it's when Bernie talks about how she's desperate to try and this guy called Woody's come to live with them, and she wants to just watch a film of her own, and she only manages to get them to put on the piano, and Woody passes out in an early. It's just so well pitched. I loved it. I wanted to move on briefly, if that's all right, to talk about how supportive you are of other writers, because I've followed you on social media for a long time, and you often do these calls out for 10 things that you can help with, and you have your book, 10 Things on Writing, which I often dip into if I just need to focus and get some inspiration. But has that always been a natural urge for you to kind of just help people as you go along?
I think it's partly because I was a teacher for such a long time. It's almost impossible to give up teaching. And also, I didn't have anybody who taught me this or who helped me on this. I had to find a lot of things out the hard way. And it struck me that with these new technologies, these social media that we have, it's just so easy to share an experience and to stop somebody making the mistake that you made or not knowing the basic thing that you didn't know. It just seems like a good thing to do, because actually we all benefit from people getting more joy out of their writing and being better at it and knowing more about the business if they want to enter it. And it seems to me that there's a lot of demystifying that needs to be done around the whole process of being published and writing, and the more transparent we are, the better, I think, for everybody. There was an article recently in the Bookseller about mental health and debut novelists, and how a lot of debut novelists find it really hard to cope when their first book comes out, because it wasn't what they expected was going to happen. Sometimes there's not enough attention, sometimes there's too much, sometimes there are all kinds of things that just mean that they're struggling. And it seems so sad that something that you should love should be causing you enough stress to actually impact on your mental health. And part of this is because we don't talk openly about all the things that being an author means enough. So, yeah, I'm just encouraging people to do that.
Isn't that one of life's cruel paradoxes, though? I mean, I love my kids, but they are not good for my mental health.
Well, it can be, but I think there are things, you know, there are things that can be done to help. And just going, oh, well, I had to go through it, so I don't see why you don't go through it. It seems a bit unkind for someone who has been through it and who can actually ease the passage for other people.
Yeah, that's true. I also love how you've created your own world that I know other authors do as well. But there was a nod in this book to St. Oswald's is where the boys went to, which is the boys' school that you've written about in Gentlemen and Players. And is that just joyful to kind of have your own map of where things happen?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I have this sort of imaginary location in Yorkshire where St. Oswald's is, but also where other books which are, you know, not set in France also tend to be set around. And so, yeah. And the more I write about it, the more I understand how that geography, that imaginary place, actually is developing. And it's a bit like writing a jigsaw puzzle in a way. I think actually all my books are connected in different ways. And at some point when my life's work is done, I think I might be able to just step back and go, here's the finished jigsaw. Here is how everything fits together. Look, you've got a complete picture here with all the books there. This is where they fit. This is how they fit together. This is the final picture. I don't know if that will ever happen, but I'm kind of still working on it.
You know, if no one's trademarked it, can we call it the Harris verse?
I think we can.
Yeah. Hey, talking of which, I don't want to in any way denigrate writers' work by suggesting the be-all and end-all is to have it translated to screen, because I know a lot of writers, the book is enough, you know? But as I was reading this, I thought, oh, 10 parts on Netflix or Amazon. But to me, it felt like a 10-part streamer rather than a film, because there's a lot of detail in it. Do you have any ambitions along those lines? Has it already been signed off and bought up?
I would love to talk about this, but actually there is something in the pipe which isn't determined yet. But yes, I would absolutely love to see it on the screen. I don't think it's a movie. I don't think any of my books would be really best as movies. I think novels generally are too complicated to reduce to the size of a movie. A movie is nearly always a reductive process. But I think now we've got these new platforms. Mm. And yes, I think a 10-part series would actually work really well, because you could really investigate some of the relationships, and you could really work on the suspense. And you could work on the individual episodes that I've put in there, which are all important, and not just have them as a beginning, a middle, and an end. Which is how most movies are constructed. I would love to see that, and I would love to see who would play Bernie and Iris, And, you know, having had one screen experience so long ago now, in which I had very little to contribute because I knew nothing, I would love to be able to actually work with somebody on this and yeah, maybe do some of the writing or...
So I was going to say, so bare minimum, you want to be an exec on this, don't you? So you want to have a casting say, but would you also like to be a screenwriter? Would you like
I've written screenplays before.
On this one, I mean, sorry.
I would actually love to do this, yes. I think, you know, it would be a bit of a challenge to put it on screen because so much of it is internalized, and I think I've got a few ideas about how that could be done. And I would love to try it because it would be a really interesting challenge.
But you know what you made me do when I read it? I'm only saying this to help if people are fearful of translating this to a screen. You made me, in my mind, imagine zooming into someone else's mind, and their mind was a living room that I might have seen on Rightmove or something years ago, and I'm starting to move the stuff around as you're describing what she's doing. And if I can do that with my imagination, there's no reason in this day and age why they can't do that on a small screen.
Exactly, I think so. And I liked the idea of people's minds being houses because Bernie is essentially a homemaker in a lot of ways. And I thought that was the kind of image that Bernie would come up with, that she would understand. She knows about, you know, dusting your mantelpiece if your mother-in-law is going to come and call and this kind of thing. She knows about keeping up appearances. And she also knows about how you put your secrets in the back room where no one's allowed to go. And I thought, you know, this is her. This is her metaphor here. I'm going to go with it because it's absolutely in character for her to see things that way.
Right. If our minds are houses, then Natalie Jameson, you first. If your mind's a house, what is it?
It's a minefield, I would say. There's a lot that goes on in my mind. And it's quite scatty, but it's also joyful and always optimistic. Well, attempts to be optimistic, but messy. Messy and organized at the same time, full of contradictions, I'd say is in my mind. I wanted to ask briefly if, and again, it doesn't matter either way because it's not why you wrote the book, I know, but whether you know if it's arrived on the desk of Stephen King or if he might read it, if that's in his
if he's world. Given you a quote for the cover.
You know what, if he gave me a quote, even if it was, "I'm sorry, I've lost the book," that would be fine. But I think actually it was sent to him. I think he actually asked for it. I'd be very curious to know what he thought, because I've been a fan of his for such a long time. Also, my editor married his son, Joe Hill. And so, you know, she should be able to get that book on his desk somehow. I don't know if she can make him read it. I mean, it might not be his thing at all, for all I know. But when I was a baby author and my very first book came out, I sent him a copy. And I said, because this book is not sold in the US, it's probably the only copy there is in the US. And I got a little postcard back saying, thank you for sending this book. But he never said whether he'd read it or not. I don't imagine he did. But I sent it anyway.
But it's great that you got a reply back anyway.
Yes, so, yeah.
Yeah, that is cool. I just want to ask briefly about cookbooks before we get your recommendations, because I love cookbooks and I love reading cookbooks and I love that marriage of food and emotion and storytelling. Are there more cookbooks you want to do as well? Is that just a really difficult medium to get across now?
It's not so much that, it's that I've run out of recipes and I don't really want to. I mean, these were all recipes that were in my books and they were all kind of French family recipes, but I'm not motivated to go, right, okay, I'm going to do a Spanish cookbook or an Indian cookbook now, because that wouldn't be me. I'm not really a writer of cookbooks. I did them partly because I wanted to give the money to MSF and also partly because people kept asking me for recipes from the book. So I thought, okay, well, we'll do these and it will be a good thing to do and it'll be fun, but it's not really the direction that I see myself going in, because I'm not really a writer of cookbooks, and I would need a lot of help in terms of making my recipes make sense, because, you know, my recipes basically start, take a big cup of this and a small cup of that and a third of that and then two more thirds of this and then a little third of something else, you know, they're experimental. And I love reading cookbooks, but I can never follow a recipe all the way. I'll read a recipe and then halfway through I'll go, oh, what if I did this? Oh, mm-hmm. What if I made it into a pie instead? And then boom, it's something completely different. So it's all experimental cooking with me.
Yeah, same. But I love reading cookbooks too, and always adapting them as I go along, because you'd never have everything in the recipe anyway. And even if I go to the supermarket, I've forgotten something. So yeah. So Joanne, what else have you enjoyed reading lately that you want to share with anybody listening?
Ooh, so many things. I get so many wonderful books sent to me, and I very rarely...
How quickly do you read a book, by the way? Because me and Phil have very different reading times on books.
It depends. If I'm enjoying it, I'll finish it in a day.
Mm. Really?
If I'm not enjoying it at all, I probably won't finish it, full disclosure, because I get sent so many and not everything is my cup of tea.
Yeah.
But no, I have really enjoyed a book called Untypical by Pete Warmby, which is a book about autism and about how we can help make modifications for autistic people in society and what it's like to be autistic and yeah, the basic things that people can do to be kind and inclusive and understand that experience. I have also massively enjoyed Juno Dawson's book, Her Majesty's Royal Coven, which is a sort of wonderful subversion of every book about witches you've ever read. which I've thought was so funny and so entertaining and so beautifully written. I thought that was absolutely great. And my other choice, and I'm trying to see if I can see it on my shelf here because I've forgotten the name of the author.
Is it Fly Fishing by J.R. Hartley?
It's not, no. However, I will find it very shortly. It's a book called Our Hideous Progeny. Mm. It's a sort of riff on Frankenstein. It's by C.E. McGill, and it's a kind of rather lovely, low-key, steampunk, historical fantasy novel. The key points are the heroine is the great-niece of Professor Frankenstein, who has disappeared and under mysterious circumstances. And she is also very keen on archaeology and science. She's married an archaeologist, and she tries to recreate her relative's experiment by effectively making a dinosaur. It's a wonderful story. It's really clever. It's sharp, it's feminist, it's all about how difficult it was to get noticed in science by women of a certain time and generation. But it's also a really good, profound exploration of what it's like to give life and what that means and all the different levels that of meaning that you can take from that. Great book. Loved it.
Echoes Amazing. Of Lessons in Chemistry as well there, isn't there? Have you read that
a little? I have read that one, yes. Yeah. It's nothing like it, but it's equally interesting.
Yeah, and the idea that women couldn't progress in science unless the man had verified the work, you know.
Exactly.
That still perpetuates today, don't you know?
So much, yes.
I've had this conversation with Phil before where we're both journalists and I thought I was going mad because I'd be in editorial meetings and I'd suggest a story idea and it would kind of like either just get ignored or nothing would happen. And then like 2 weeks later, somebody else, a man, would suggest the same idea. And I'd be sitting there going, pretty sure I had that idea. And then all of a sudden it would get commissioned. I was like, yeah. Why does this keep happening? And obviously being female, I was like, oh, I must be doing something wrong. It must be the way I'm presenting myself.
Ugh. Yeah, I'm afraid we still get that from time to time. Mm.
Thank you so much for speaking to us. We've really enjoyed it. And we both really enjoyed this book. I hope that came across to you.
Thank you. It's so nice to hear that you enjoyed it. And it's been a pleasure talking to you both. Thank you.
Wasn't that just a delightful way to spend an hour? I'm so genuinely so thrilled that we got that with Joanne.
I just want to convey to you listening that we do these on Zoom and I can see Natalie's little face. And I don't think I've seen you that excited for a guest. I can't remember the last. No, like genuinely. Almost, I would say, you were a little bit like it was putting you on edge a bit, wasn't it? Because you were so in awe.
I did feel a bit nervous beforehand. I think it's just because...
Which is nice. I'm not mocking you over that. That's the thing. That's
no,
a
I know.
Thing.
And
we shouldn't lose that. If you lose that, what's the point in doing it? Yeah.
Well, exactly. But I think it's just that when you really respect somebody, I think... It's really hard to say that you're a fan of somebody and to quantify what that means, because societally, often, if you're like, you're a fan, there's not much more you can say other than like, I love your work, or like, it's brilliant. Or, you know, we have been very fortunate in our careers to move in circles where we've got to meet some brilliant people who've created like film and music and books that we love and get to say thank you for that. But it's kind of, how can you convey that without just sounding like you're gushing.
Well, I think the way you do that is the way you did it, which is you qualify it. So you don't just say, I love the books.
Yeah.
Big fan, stuff like that. Those are empty phrases.
Great.
So you tell you what I loved about this book is the way that you blah, 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 and then you quantify, and then they know that you're not. My dad said to me once he'd enjoyed one of my interviews on it. And when I said, why?
Just one.
He's a very selective critic. When I asked why, he said, because you shut up and let the guest talk. And he said, when I'm tuning in, you're like the most important person your guest is. And I went, okay, right. And that was very early on in my career. And I thought, oh, he's got a point there.
Yes.
And that's much better feedback than, oh, great interview with blah. And you go, oh, thanks very much. And then the conversation moves on. And you don't really know why they loved it.
That's true. That is true. Yeah, I think that's really good advice. I'm the same. Like, I hate it when interviewers make it all about them rather than about the person. But I'm just my brain was going a bit slowly because I was like, did I do that a bit in this? Because you kind of want to almost
picture
of yourself.
If you're talking about a book where one of the central themes is something that you've experienced and are heading into, then why would you not introduce that? Do you know what I mean? That would be remiss of you, I think.
I'm also fascinated.
About being perimenopausal, can I? So I'm relying on you to give us that.
Well, that's the thing. Like in that chat we were having with Joanne about, you know, what may happen with Broken Light and how we might see it adapted for the screen. It's just that thing where you can, I don't think it happens as much as it probably used to, but this is not a book where you want, you know, the 25-year-old hotshot male screenwriter to take a crack at the script. You want somebody with a lived experience. I really hope she gets to work on it.
So it's Joanne Harris's Broken Light, and I hope you enjoyed that. And now we need to say our thank yous because we've been telling you over the last couple of episodes that we are now on Ko-fi.com, which is ko-fi.com. So Ko-fi is a way where if you like what we do and you'd like to support us to keep doing it, you can buy us a coffee. And I realise that we're asking you to do this in a cost of living crisis, and if you can't afford it, it's fine. But if you can afford it, we would greatly appreciate it. Because it's just Natalie and me that do these. There's no great army behind us. We don't have a huge production company behind us. We have no marketing budget or anything like that.
And we haven't worked out how to get opposable thumbs onto cats because I have four of them and they could do some of the editing if only I could brainwash them.
Oh, wouldn't that be a joy?
Come on, cats, it's your turn.
We need to say thank you, Ray Blake. If you're listening, Ray Blake's brought us a coffee. So thank you to Ray. Thank you to Patricia, who bought us a coffee as well. So the kind of first couple that we've had through. So thank you very much. And if you go to ko-fi.com, ko-fi.com/bestsellerspodcast, then you will find us there and you can buy us a brew if you so desire. And we'll be back very, very soon because we've just crowded out our summer, haven't we, with great writers.
We have. Yeah, we're keeping going. We're going to be dropping weekly episodes of chats with authors, but also what Phil and I have been reading as well, because we so often get asked about that we hope that's going to be useful when you're planning some summer reading or just any reading. So yeah, enjoy and thanks.